You are listening to a Science Actually production.
Hansel, so hot right now. Hansel.
I would like to take this up.
I like talking about diagrams about stars.
I mean, I was pretty cool. They're like cool stars.
They're like hot stars. I was like looking at the star. I'm like, it's like really, really like hot. You know, like it's like hot, but it's also like bright. You know, it was like
bright, right.
And I was like, why are you doing that, star? Why are you like colder? Why don't you like feel like colder?
Stars are so hot right now. Just
stars
so hot.
Are so hot. Stars are like so hot right now. Stars are like so hot right now.
This is the point that we lost in the Mugatu reference. While you're choking in the background on your own laughter, I will welcome our fans, guys, gals, and non-binary pals. Welcome to our latest episode of Science Actually Presents the Nerd and the Scientist. With me, Colby Rose, and him, Benjamin Zellis, who is breathing. He's alive. He's good.
I'm back. I had to write that down. That was just, oh my God. Just hitting the record button when he feels fanciful.
Well, we have so much good banter before we start recording. I wish we got everything before that, leading up to that shenanigans. But alas. Okay.
Stars are like so hot right now.
So I guess our listeners and our watchers may have an inkling or a twinkling of what we're going to be discussing today. But if you haven't guessed, do you want to put the good folks out of their misery, Benjamin, and tell them what we are chatting about today?
Today, we are talking about the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram. The Hertzsprung-Russell diagram.
Is it not the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram?
It's a nice diagram on the stars. Of the stars. The Hertzsprung-Russell diagram in astronomy is a graph in which the absolute magnitudes of stars are plotted against their special spectral types.
Yes. And
that's the episode.
That's the episode. Bye.
Ta-ta.
Ta-ta. Yes. So the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, otherwise known as the HR diagram, is this diagram that we use a lot in astronomy. That's kind of like a scatter plot. Mm-hmm. And it has stars scattered all over. And generally speaking, the horizontal axis of the plot shows its temperature, or a proxy for its temperature, its color or spectral type. And then the vertical axis, the up and downy bit, will show you how bright it is or how luminous it is. So that's what we're going to be talking about. I'm going to be describing a diagram this whole episode. So anybody who's listening and not watching, good luck.
Imagine a graph, piece of graph paper, and the x-axis, as Kavi says, is represents the color or temperature of stars, and the y-axis represents how bright it is, and you put a dot on that chart for every star that you've observed.
Yes.
In time, you're going to have a lot of dots.
A lot of dots.
Thank you and good night. Now, there is a actual pattern that will come to light as you see it. As a matter of fact, the part that I liked is that 90% of all stars fall into this kind of wavy diagonal line that goes down across the chart from the brightest and, I believe, whitest, right? Or brightest and hottest at the top left, all the way down towards the dimmest and coldest or reddish at the bottom right. And that big cluster, I guess you can call it, that big stripe, that wavy stripe, that's called the main sequence. And that's where the bulk of offices reside.
Exactly. So this main, the main clustering, if you take thousands or millions of stars that we observe with telescopes up in space or wherever, and you plot them on an HR diagram, you'll notice that the majority of the stars tend to fall along this diagonal line that goes from the top left, which shows the most luminous and bluest and hottest stars, down to the bottom right, which show the faintest and most red stars. And this is called the main sequence, and it's where most stars basically spend the majority of their lifetimes, generally speaking, billions of years. And during this time, they fuse hydrogen into helium. So you know, stars can form, and there are different processes when they're forming. And then after, when they're older stars and they have moved off the main sequence, they can be fusing other heavier elements as they get closer to the end of their lives. But for the most part, for the majority of their lives, they're on this main sequence. It's their jam. It's like Main Street for stars.
It's the mainstream stars. That's something that I was, in all the reading I was doing about the diagram, is the fact that it contributed to the discovery of stellar lifespans, basically, where stars have come from and where they're going to go over time. And I was trying to wonder how. There's no mention of time on this chart. It's a snapshot, I guess you could say, of all the stars that we see now. The sun is kind of somewhere closer to the middle-ish, and it's just sitting there. How do we know that from, or rather, how does this contribute to us knowing the sun is going to become a red giant and therefore on this chart go straight up on the chart? How did that stellar lifespan part come from this?
Yeah, that's a great question.
Let's get
deep. It's deep. what we've basically been able to get better and better at is to understand stellar evolution through kind of a chemical perspective, and we might end up talking a lot about spectroscopy this episode, which we've touched on before. But right, generally, you can break down the light that's coming from a star or from any light source into its composite rainbow. And when you're talking about a real object, as opposed to, you know, just like a white light from your phone, a real object, especially things like a star, will have missing bits in the rainbow. They'll have either like really bright spots where you have extra emission, or missing bits, like dark spots where it's missing emission. And those absorption and emission lines tell you about the chemical composition of the thing that you're looking at, or at the very least, the thing that's in front of the thing that you're looking at, as light might get absorbed by the material that's passing through. And so by looking at these spectra, right, these little fun rainbows from stars, we can understand their chemical composition, and we can understand the different chemical compositions that different stars have throughout their lifetimes.
Okay, cool. I have some more questions about this wonderful map.
sure. What you now, got?
As we discussed, or just covered, 90% of the stars that are can be plotted on that main sequence-y stripe going down through it. But that's not all of them. There's a group towards the bottom, separate from the rest of the stars, where white dwarfs live.
Yes.
And it's a very distinct group, very separate from it. There's a branch towards the top of it that kind of branches off, and those are your super giants. There's a cluster that comes off the middle of it towards the top. That's the regular, I guess, giants. But not connected in any way, very separate from everything else. There's this little blob or cloud of white giants. White dwarfs. What's in between? Why are they down there far away from the rest of the main sequence? And how come there's nothing in between? If you look at the chart from the main sequence line and above, it's peppered with stars. But below it, there's a kind of a void. And is that void significant in any way?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Well, it's probably like, you know, three great questions in a trench coat pretending to be one question. But depending on which HR diagram you're looking at, you might see these regions like more or less clearly defined and separate. But what we've been realizing recently is that the better our observations, the more stars that we measure, the more we're realizing that there are actually stars that do fill that gap. And I'll return to that point in a second. Because that has to do with binary stars, and that's a whole other kettle of fish. White dwarfs are really, really, really interesting because evolutionarily they are related to main sequence stars, right? It's not like things move in any sort of linear way in the way that they evolve across an HR diagram. So most solar mass stars that have a similar mass to our sun, up to even a couple of times the mass of our sun. As you said, they'll evolve into a red giant, and then after that, they'll shed their outer layers, and then they will kind of condense down into a white dwarf. A white dwarf is basically this stage at the end of a low-mass star's life, relatively low mass. So we're talking about, you know, things similar to the sun, not like a brown dwarf that's like, you know, an ultra-cool dwarf, and it's super-duper low mass. Things like the sun. And if you think back to the episode that we did on planetary nebulae, right? Which have nothing to do with planets, right? So what you're seeing in a planetary nebula for the most part will be this outer layer of a former giant star. So like the gas that it shed. And then the inside is the white dwarf or the proto-white dwarf, the thing that's going to turn into it. And basically what this is, what the white dwarf is what's left over from the star when the star cannot do nuclear fusion anymore. And it's just this simmering, you know, roughly speaking, it's this kind of simmering hot ember of the core of the star, of what remains. Now, there are people who will argue that it's possible for like white dwarfs to get reignited and do a little bit of nuclear fusion, but for the most part, generally speaking, white dwarfs aren't continuing to produce, like, they're not continuing to do like fusion. They are just losing their temperature slowly over time. Cooling until down. Eventually, yeah, after billions of years, they will cool down to become black dwarfs. But these have never been observed because, as far as I understand, it would take longer than the universe has existed for a white dwarf to completely cool and become a black dwarf.
Hasn't been enough time to happen.
Yep. Cool. Yep. Yeah. But there is stuff that's happening in the space between the white dwarfs and the main sequence. There are, you know, most stars that we see in the night sky are actually in binaries. They're in pairs. And so a lot of these stars that fill this space between the main sequence and the area where the white dwarfs live are actually binaries of a white dwarf and another star. And so when we see that binary together, it's not a clear classification that we can make of, you know, is it a white dwarf, is it a main sequence star? it's somewhere in between, and so it can fall in this valley between the white dwarfs and the main sequence.
That's interesting.
These are sometimes called CVs, cataclysmic variables, and they're called such because they are kind of like the precursors for novae. These like really powerful flares that go off, you know, on scales of years. Every time, like the white dwarf pulls a bit of material from the star that it's orbiting with. So yeah, okay. I don't know if that answers your question.
It answers a lot of questions. It does. I read an article on all the bajillions of articles that I share in Science Actually. A couple of days ago, I shared one about the cataclysmic variable thing you just mentioned. That kind of just, oh yeah, I just read something semi-related. Okay, made me very happy. Where, Kavi, does your pizza oven star that you discovered, where does it fall on the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram?
Gosh. Okay, so my star falls kind of, it's like right in the lower bottom right corner. I think on most HR diagrams, it wouldn't actually be on there.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. After the ad break, I did want to talk about the classification system.
Okay.
Because we have O stars, B stars, A stars, F stars, G stars, K stars, and M stars, right? O, B, A, F, G, K, not the planets. right. These are these different spectral types that are used for classifying stars according to temperature and according to hydrogen emission lines, again, that we see in spectra, otherwise known as Balmer lines, B-A-L-M-E-R, Balmer. And this classification system was discovered by a group of incredible women who were working at Radcliffe College in the early 1900s. So it's kind of, now it's part of Harvard University, but it was, you know, this kind of separate college because the women were not allowed to be part of the main college. And you have folks like Henrietta Swan Leavitt and Annie Jump Cannon and Cecilia Payne Kaposhkin. And they incredibly looked at the spectra for hundreds of thousands of stars and classified them into these categories, O, B, A, F, G, K, M, in order to identify what type of star they were. So like the HR diagram is super cool, but it should maybe be named after them. Well, but yeah.
Yes. We'll get to the name of it in a second because I have a question about that as well.
Gosh. Do we want to pause for an ad break or do we want to keep going on this?
I do. Let's do it. Let's
okay.
Hit me.
Okay. Hey, Benjamin, are you tired of naming stars? Are you bored of claiming constellations?
Yes.
Well, now you can name an Earthling. That's right. Introducing nameanearthling.com, the groundbreaking service that lets you slap your name on a complete stranger. Newborn, teen, Uncle Greg who just sits on the couch. We've got them all. Name any Earthling and get a certificate proving that you chose their identity. Dad, why is my name Captain Pickles? Why not? Get creative and just for $19.99, they can never legally change it. Ever. Service not recognized by any government. Earthling may refuse to respond to their new name. Name a star? Nah. Name an Earthling because somebody's got to answer to Captain Pickles. Nameanearthling.com. Make it personal.
I freaking love that. I've named a few Earthlings. I wouldn't mind naming a few more. Can you imagine just getting something in the mail? Sorry, sweetie, you're Mr. Pickles. But Mom, sorry, nothing I can do about it.
Nope.
Nothing.
Nope. I was trying to think, that's basically the equivalent of what we do. We just decide to, name stars, buy stars. And there's no actual legitimacy to it at all. Sorry. Sorry for people listening.
Some eccentric billionaire that picks a small country, named everybody Steve. There. Steve.
Ah, yes, Planet Steve. God, imagine being on Planet Steve and in a crowded room looking for someone named Steve. Steve?
Yes. No, not you. I met Steve.
Oh, of course. Yeah. Okay, did you, you had a question
about the spectral pulses? Back to the chart.
Yes, back to the chart.
It was first drawn up by a Danish astronomer, Ejnar Hertzsprung, in 1911. Mm-hmm. But then an American astronomer, Henry Norris Russell, came up with the same thing independently in 1913. But mm-hmm. I also read that Hertzsprung cooked up the original chart using the data gathered by Annie Jump Canyon, as you mentioned, and others, in 1911. But Russell added just yet more data from another catalog of stars to the same chart. Mm. And he did that on his own, supposedly. And it got the name of Hertzsprung-Russell because they both did it. Although mm-hmm. they did it independently, they did the same thing. Russell did it first. Hertzsprung did it first. Russell did it more. So who's the real hero? Who's really...
Annie Jump Cannon. It's the real
hero. Now we're talking. Now we're talking. Now we're talking.
I mean, as... So myself and some of the people I work with, we like to joke that we are commensal astronomers. A commensal astronomer is a fancy way of saying somebody else has taken this data and we are going to use it. Now, obviously, I also do my own observations with, you know, a telescope that I plan the observation, do the observation myself and blah, blah, blah. But it's interesting how this was, you know, kind of over 100 years ago, we're already seeing this divide between the people who gather the data and the people who do the science. And, you know, it's just, it's kind of groundbreaking because you think about not only the oppression of women generally, but especially in science at that time, and you look at the number of Nobel Prizes that have direct links to this research that was done by people like Annie Jump Cannon and Henrietta Leavitt and Cecilia Payne, it's phenomenal. I mean, like the ability for us to measure distances in the universe, right? Because we have that parallax method, right? Which works well for nearby stars. So parallax, for folks who aren't familiar, if you hold up your finger at an arm's length, using your arm as the length of that arm, a standard arm, and you kind of open and close your eyes, left eye, right eye, left eye, right eye, you'll notice that the position of your finger shifts slightly, right? Relative to the background. Yep. So that's a parallax because you're basically measuring the position of your finger from two different locations, left eye and right eye. And so when we do this with stars and the position of the point of measurement that's changing is the Earth's position. So say that we, you know, measure a star's position in June and we measure it in January, the Earth will be on opposing sides of the sun. And so you're kind of also creating these like alternate sides to measure from. That slight shift in the position of the star is a parallax, and the inverse of that will give you a measure of the distance to the star. And that's awesome. That's great. But that doesn't work for stars that are further and further away that have vanishingly smaller parallaxes. At a certain point, it's kind of impossible to measure these tiny changes. And so Henrietta Leavitt's work on variable stars, which she was studying in the Magellanic Clouds, and she realized, hang on, all of these stars are at the same distance. Roughly speaking, because they're all in this, you know, dwarf galaxy, the Magellanic Cloud. But looking at these varying stars that have regular pulsations, she was able to determine a relationship between the period of the stars, how often they pulsate, and their luminosity, their true luminosity, right? And then once you have that relationship, you can then look at other stars that are more distant, that have this, that hold the same relationship, and you can figure out what distance they're at. And so that method allowed us to take another step in the distance ladder. So parallax work for things that are super close by, period luminosity for things a little bit further away, And this work was critical to Edwin Hubble, who eventually, you know, did incredible things in understanding the expansion of the universe. So yeah, like every time I hear HR diagram, I kind of tend to think of the women who actually collected the data upon which the science is based, rather than the dudes who it was named after, if that was makes sense. Like not that they just, you know, not to take away from their hard work, but I think the true heroes, in this case, are definitely those women.
That was nice.
Which is, gosh, it's kind of ironic then that, so the acronym or the mnemonic, I should say, that people use to remember the order of the spectral classes. Are you familiar with this?
I know that it's, because we've joked about it before. I had my gripe with M-class stuff from sci-fi movies and TV shows. So we kind of touched upon it briefly. Goodness knows how many dozens of episodes ago.
Oh, yeah.
But I know there's a bunch of letters that make no sense. So this would absolutely help.
Okay, so the standard one, and again, it's kind of like ironically sexist or slightly problematic, given that this was work that was done by this incredible group of female astronomers, but the classic mnemonic is OBA fine girl, kiss me, or OBA fine guy, kiss me. And that kind of hasn't aged well. Most astronomers will not use that. And there are some great replacements. So only boring astronomers find gratitude knowing mnemonics.
I don't like that one because mnemonic starts with an M, but it's pronounced with an N.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Only boring astronomers fight green killer Martians.
I am liking it.
I
think that's a brave. Brave.
Brave. Astronomers. How about only Bob ate fresh gummy karate monkeys?
Gummy karate monkeys.
No, problem.
That's a stretch, but in my house it would work because I have a son who would, if he could, eat nothing but gummy items. And karate monkey is something I can easily remember. So in my house, yeah, that would work. But I don't know how well that would be received elsewhere.
Well, it's a problem because as you mentioned, you alluded to the pizza oven temperature brown dwarf that I was working on last year. And that actually goes, as I mentioned, beyond the standard diagram, right? So mm-hmm. these cooler dwarfs, these M dwarfs, are not the end, because after M, you have L-type brown dwarfs, L-type stars, T-type stars, and Y dwarfs. Y dwarfs are like, you know, livable temperatures almost, tens of degrees. And so you need a whole new mnemonic, like... Only because astronomers fail greatly knowing many luminous types. Yo.
Yo. All right. Well, wait a second. So if we're going back to the comet or the thing that we talked about just earlier in this episode about white dwarfs, and they're slowly going to decrease in temperature to become a black dwarf, and they haven't done that because there's simply not enough time yet in the existence of the universe. But there is a Y-type star that's tens of degrees.
I think I know where you're going with this. This is a very interesting question. This is a very, very interesting question. So what you're suggesting is that... Today. no, I'd never thought about this, right? So the white dwarf region on an HR diagram...
Right.
...does kind of... what would I call like this shape? It kind of arcs kind of down
arc,
from
like a little arc,
yeah, right? From like yeah. slightly hotter white dwarfs, because you know you can have white dwarfs that have temperatures of, you know, 10,000 or even a little bit higher degrees Kelvin, and then they decrease in luminosity and decrease in temperature, and you can get white dwarfs down to a few thousand degrees, But the process that creates brown dwarfs, which go even further down in temperature, down to hundreds or tens of degrees is a completely different physical process in the way that we understand it. So as mentioned, white dwarfs were previously sun-like stars that okay. had a life of billions of years, did the thing, burn the hydrogen, fuse the hydrogen, right?
You know, they starred. Stars got a star.
They starred. Yeah. Oh, they were the star of the show for billions of years. But brown dwarfs are kind of... almost had Benjamin choking on his water. If I had made that joke a second later, it would have been a spit take.
Sorry, continue.
Brown dwarfs are... they're kind of, people consider them to be failed stars because okay. the initial mass that they have as they move towards, as they evolve towards the main sequence, is not enough mass to do the thing, to fuse hydrogen. So brown dwarfs never get to that stage, never get to that level where they can stably burn hydrogen for billions of years. They can do a fusion of deuterium, but they're kind of just held together by gravitational forces, and they will continue to be so for billions of years. Brown dwarfs, especially these ultra-cool brown dwarfs, are some of the oldest known objects in the universe, the longest-lived stars or dwarf stars. I guess there's this region... down the bottom of the HR diagram where the coolest and faintest white dwarfs can encroach towards some of the M dwarfs or K dwarfs from the main sequence, but evolutionarily and in terms of like their origin story, kind of different.
Okay. All right. That is kind of cool.
Ultra cool.
Ultra cool, like the failed star at the bottom.
Sorry, I had to.
I, as you mentioned, there are varieties of HR diagrams that
yes
things, and I came across one that I found interesting. It's the same HR diagram that we've been discussing with temperature and lumosity. Temperature and color going one way and lumosity going the other way. Mm-hmm. And you have the main sequence going down and everything. But imposed upon the x-axis and the y-axis, there's a bunch of diagonal lines that describe the physical size of the stars.
Yep.
And there's this, I guess the main sequence stars, the bulk of them anyway, falls between the size of 0.1 solar radius mm-hmm. radii to 10 mm-hmm. radii solar radii. Our sun, of course, is smack in the middle at one.
Does our sun have one solar radius? That's crazy.
Our sun is where the middle is, yeah, of that little section. And that, the further down and to the left you go, the smaller, the physically smaller the size. And the further up and right you go, the physically bigger you get, hence giants and supergiants. So the silly question, are there ever any, to all rules, there's an exception. Is there ever a giant or a supergiant white dwarf? Is there ever a giant that falls below the main sequence? Or is there ever a dwarf that could be found above the main sequence, or is that just me asking silly questions based on a picture?
There are no such thing as silly questions.
Okay. And only which one of these stars wears bunny ears? There you go. Here's your silly question.
I think it's not as silly of a question as you might think. Generally, the reason why white dwarfs have the size that they have and giants and supergiants have, the size that they have, is this balance between forces on the star that are pulling inwards, namely gravitational forces, and these kind of radiative and nuclear forces pushing outwards, especially, you know, in the case of supergiants, as we mentioned, we spoke about how like these outer layers puff up, and it's kind of like thermodynamically something that that controls the size that we see. And so this was the case, right, in those variable stars that we mentioned that Henrietta Leavitt was working on. So those stars varied in brightness, in luminosity, and technically in radius as these subsurface layers underwent these thermodynamic processes that caused the star to kind of beat, right? And increase and decrease in size.
Okay.
And so the cooler things and the things that don't have these processes going on shrink down, right? That's why we see cooler brown dwarfs and the cooler white dwarfs shrinking down in size. Because basically the gravity can condense them. And as things cool down, they will condense. As things heat up, and they will, you know, expand. But I think the interesting part of that question is what I mentioned earlier about most stars being in binaries. And so when we look at these super bright stars and we classify them according to their luminosity, if there's another star in that binary that's fainter, we might be missing it. Right? Uh-huh. So in the same way that I mentioned that there are some cataclysmic variables or white dwarf binaries that live in that middle space between the main sequence and the white dwarf area, you can have white dwarf binaries with a brown dwarf that would live completely in the white dwarf region, because the brown dwarf that it is orbiting with, right, its binary buddy, is so faint that we don't see it relative to the white dwarf. And the same can be said of, you know, a lower mass star that's orbiting with
the collective measurements of these two things and
classifying
as one thing. Okay.
Exactly. And so that's where spectral measurements, you know, we don't necessarily have the resolution in our telescopes to be able to differentiate them. But if we look at their spectra, we look at their rainbows, we can differentiate, okay, this rainbow that we're seeing, this spectra that we're seeing, or this spectrum, is a composite of the spectra of a brown dwarf and the spectra of a white dwarf. And we can, you know, understand that there are two things there.
Got it.
Yes.
Okay.
I feel like Benjamin is surprised because he wasn't sure that we could do a whole episode on this, but
no, I got a couple more questions.
Let's do it. Let's hear them.
There's a movie coming out this week, Beetlejuice.
There is. Yes. Coming,
and that's the very top right of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram.
What star was that?
It's very, very bright and not as hot as. And also, I've noticed towards the top center, there's a, on the hot white section of the supergiants area, mm-hmm. there is a star called Deneb. And I was wondering, is that the same Deneb where Lando Calrissian made his famous maneuver that got him promoted to general? Or is that a different one?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure about that.
This guy doesn't know how to face it. Just say yes. Just have some fun. Say yes.
Yeah, yes. Yes.
Thank you.
I mean, you know, we're not talking about the fact that you can probably see Alderaan on some of these HR diagrams. Nobody talks about Alderaan anymore, do they?
Nope. It's just too soon. Too soon. funny thing I've been reading. I read a lot of articles today and a couple last night. And also one last week when you first suggested that we do an episode about this diagram. A running theme, a lot of these articles are written by astronomers such as yourself trying to explain what the diagram is. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have taken the time to put into their articles a little explanation. This does not plot the position of these stars in relation to each other. They're not all together in a big long string, whatever. This is just a way to plot their color or temperature against their brightness. And mm-hmm. is there, I'm trying to formulate the question. I have written down, I can't read because my glass is fogging up. is there any, with charts such as these, is there ever a lot of misunderstanding? Again, a lot of astronomers are writing that, you know, this is not where the stars actually are. This is just their brightness and their temperature. But is there any misuse of this chart? I have a follow-up question to that. And I think I asked that poorly.
I don't, no, I think I get what you're saying. I think it's great that people writing those articles have included a mention, like a warning, like these stars are not actually this close to each other. We're just like doing a scatter plot to show where their luminosities and temperatures lie. But that's not a confusion that I've come across with others. I think one complication that often occurs is, you know, we speak about how the vertical axes will be luminosity or absolute magnitude. So absolute magnitude is the brightness that they would have if you were exactly 10 parsec away from them, as opposed to apparent magnitude, which is the brightness that we observe from Earth. And then the other thing that's a more common, I don't want to say confusion, but like, you know, potential obstacle that people have to be careful of is the fact that the temperature and the color will not, like, there's no like simple clear classification or formula that like links temperature and color in terms of observables, because there can be a whole range of things that mess up the color, for example, that we're observing. So one example is what's called extinction or interstellar reddening. So as a result of looking towards a dustier and more crowded region of the galaxy, so for example, if it's a star that's in the direction of the galactic center as opposed to away from the center of the galaxy, the color of the star will be shifted towards red, even if the true color of the star is not that red, as a result of the fact that we're looking through this dusty medium. So that's the sort of thing that has to be taken into account to get like the proper color in order to convert that into a temperature. That's kind of the only thing I can think of off the top of my head. Yeah.
One more question.
Yes, you in the back.
Hello. The diagram is awesome.
Thank you.
And it helps people visualize how this particular grouping of stars by these variables. And this helps people realize that there's a pattern, and it's an excellent teaching tool. Mm-hmm. But is this something that you, Kavi, is it something that you can actually use as a tool in your day-to-day mm-hmm. research? Is that something you can take information from, or is it something that you contribute to? Is that part of your job?
Mm, yeah. I mean, like the short answer is yes, 100%. Okay, we're done. Yeah, that's it. We're done. Bye. No, the longer answer is yes. So like I work a lot with radio transients, like weird things that go bang in the sky. And the first thing that I'll try to do is to cross match this radio source that I found to a known star, known optical source, because optical just has the numbers. You have satellites like Gaia, which are, you know, space-based telescopes that have millions and millions of stars that they have identified. And so seeing the Gaia HR diagram, so that's a diagram that shows the Gaia measured color and the Gaia measured absolute magnitude brightness. Looking at a Gaia HR diagram, I can figure out what sort of star the radio transient that I found is likely to be. And this, yeah, this is an incredibly useful tool that I use often. Yeah.
Oh, right on. So it's not just a pretty face. It's actually a useful thing. All right, cool.
Are you talking about me or the diagram?
Both. Hubba, hubba, hubba. I like my diagrams.
Well, thank you, sir.
Man, look at us learning. Well, look at me learning. Look at you teaching. This is great.
Look at me teaching. love it. Love it. Did you have any more questions about stellar classification?
No.
No. That's okay. No. This is a good episode.
No, I guess I think I'm going over my notes real fast. I think I covered everything I wanted to ask. Yes, I think we're good to go. I'm happy. I have pictures of the diagram next to me. I highly recommend people putting a picture up on their screen and just taking a gander. It's actually pretty interesting to see just how absolutely wild and random the universe is. And yet there's a beautiful pattern that all that randomness follows. And it's just fancy. It's amazing to see that.
It's wonderful.
Method to the madness.
And then when you look at the HR diagram made with real data, if you plot Gaia stars or stars from some catalog, this order sometimes looks like a bird and sometimes looks like a dragon, depending on how you look at it. Yeah.
I see that. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I see that.
Love it. And if folks listening at home are interested in learning more about the HR diagram, you're welcome to send in your questions, comment on this episode, wherever you found it.
Please.
Maybe share with us your favorite HR diagram that you found. And you know, maybe there are some that we haven't seen before.
I would love to find out more about it. That sounds awesome. Kavi.
Wonderful. Yes.
Where can people reach out to you to tell you about their thoughts on HR diagrams?
People can find me via Carrier Pigeon. Due to the recent lack of pigeons, people can also find me at Fun Fact Science all over the interwebs, on the social medias, and all those places. Benjamin, where can the good people track you down?
You can find me under the name of Science Actually on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Threads, Hive, Mastodon, LinkedIn, and of course, you can find this episode and this show on the TikTok, on the YouTube, and you can visit scienceactually.com/podcast.
Love it. See you next time.
See you next time, everybody.
That Hansel's so hot right now.